The Guardian.
Guardian podcasts are partnered with audible.co.uk. For a free download, be sure to check out guardian.co.uk/audible, where Guardian listeners can choose any audiobook for free. See the page for more details.
Hello, this is Science Weekly. I'm Alok Jha. On the show this week...
And so having done a couple of bad virus stories, in the finals I tried to flip it. Hollywood makes them out to be the big baddies. But actually, we interact with them so much more than we think, and people are starting to use them in very good ways.
We'll meet some of the winners and a finalist from this year's FameLab. It's a bit like The Voice, but for scientists. In this year's UK competition, Lucy Thorne and Andrew Steele both did very well indeed. They'll both be joining me here in the studio. And
there might be a few people locked away in their labs doing evil things, but by and large, the vast majority of scientists are doing it because they believe it's worthwhile.
In a science communication double bill, we'll hear from scientist and broadcaster Alice Roberts. She was recently appointed as Professor of Public Engagement at the University of Birmingham and has some choice words to say about the role academics should be playing in making sure science gets a fair hearing in wider society. I'll also be joined by Ian Sample a bit later to discuss some of this week's science news, including the launch of the very first commercial spaceship to the International Space Station. This is Science Weekly from The Guardian. In the music business, there's X Factor, there's Pop Idol, The Voice, and countless other talent shows. In science, we've got FameLab. This is an international competition to find the next generation of science communicators. Every year, budding presenters and communicators from the world of science put on a short skit of around 3 minutes, a compelling case for their area of research and science in general. This year's UK competition was won by Andrew Steele, a recent PhD student from the University of Oxford, whose field of investigation is new forms of magnetism. Close second was Lucy Thorne, a biologist and postgrad student specialising in infectious diseases at Imperial College London. Welcome to Science Weekly, both of you, and congratulations on being the FameLab UK winners / finalists. Andrew, first of all, you tell us what your skit was at the finals and during the heats as well. What were you talking about?
So there were three rounds in FameLab. There was an Oxford local heat, then there was a regional southeast heat, which was also in Oxford, and then the national final. In the first round, I talked about how to use a CD and a serial box to make a spectrometer, so a device for analysing light, and how we could use one of those devices to look at the distant stars and work out what they're made of without having to spend millions of years travelling there. Then in the second round, complete change of tack, I talked about clouds and how human activity is making clouds whiter and consequently reflecting more sunlight back into space and having an effect on the climate. And finally, in the final, I talked about quantum mechanics. I talked about how we can use quantum mechanics to understand the colour of vegetables, in particular why carrots are orange.
And each of these are what, 2 or 3 minutes
so
maximum?
There's a 3 minute time limit, so you've got to get everything
in.
Do you
get boos and heckles, or is it kind of a very friendly crowd?
They're generally quite friendly. They're all, you know, quite interested in science.
Paused a bit there. There were some boos, weren't there?
There was
heckles.
Just the odd one.
That's not quantum mechanics, one of the profs probably said. Lucy, what were your subjects?
So I work on viruses. I'm studying viruses. So that was my theme throughout. But the first one, I asked the audience, what do hospitals, schools, cruise ships, and some of Britain's top restaurants have in common, which is that they're the hunting ground for norovirus. Or the winter vomiting bug.
God, you know how to make people feel happy, don't
well,
you?
So yeah, this is... I tried to turn it around and talk about how you might want to design the ideal drug for them. And then in the second round, I told a bit of a swine flu story, that it's escaped from the pigs just to be confronted with our antivirals and how do they get round it, which is by mutating and escaping, which viruses like flu are really good at. And so having done a couple of bad virus stories, in the finals I tried to flip it and do, is there such thing as a good virus? You know, Hollywood makes them out to be the big baddies. But actually, we interact with them so much more than we think, and people are starting to use them in very good ways.
What are the good viruses?
Well, the ones that I focused on were the way that we're in a great position now. We know so much about them that we can use them to our advantage. And there's a big field trying to use viruses to treat cancers and to use them to take them on to kill them as a potential cancer therapy.
So using their sort of skills at getting into cells and killing cells.
Exactly.
For our good. Well, we'll maybe come back onto that when we talk a bit about your research later. Andrew, tell us how you got involved in this. This idea of talking about some bit of science for 3 minutes in front of an audience is not something that all PhD students or professors get involved in. Yet FameLab has been running for many years doing just that. So where did you hear about it? How did you decide this is what I'm going to do? Because it's quite daunting.
Yeah, I'm actually not sure where I heard about it. I guess
you just wake up doing it one day.
I think I was just born for this task. Yeah, I think it's a really valuable thing, and more academics and PhD students should get involved with this sort of thing, because it's a great way to condense down the ideas in your research, or indeed in broader fields of science, down to this really, really tiny 3 minute thing. And the 3 minute thing is actually really, really hard. So I think one reason to get involved is it's a really great exercise to just try and pare down what you're trying to say to the very bare essentials and get a point.
Did you find that hard?
Yes, very, very
hard. I mean, what was hard about it? Is it that you think, oh, I wish I could tell them so much more? Or is it that just expressing something clearly for 3 minutes is in itself a performance is quite tough?
I mean, I think it's a bit of both. There's a lot. I mean, I've got a PhD in physics, so I've studied science in ludicrous depth for a number of years. And so there's always just one more thing that would really be the final brilliant clinching example that would make the 3.5 minute talk absolutely perfect. But there's never that extra 30 seconds. But I guess, yeah, I mean, also, you're quite right that it's very hard choosing the topics, because you've got to think of something that you can go from potentially zero understanding to a full sort of elegant concept in that tiny period of time.
I mean, Lucy, how did you choose the subject? People are familiar with viruses, or at least they think they are, with the diseases and things. So how did you go about choosing the angles you're going to go with?
The first two, I think, were things that I've worked on. So in a way, they were almost preformed ideas. But as Andrew said, condensing them into 3 minutes with a nice take home and a complete story was very difficult.
Tell me your process. If you're researching something for many years and you've done a degree in it, how do you condense that into 3 minutes?
Picking the good questions to ask and to answer was important. I did a lot of trials on my flatmates to kind of work out what words people know and what people, as you said, what do people actually know about viruses and the disease. And so,
did you find it surprising, actually, when you were testing this out?
Yeah, parts of it, because I think having worked in this field for a while now, you forget what words are common use and at what stage people learn and absorb things as well. So there were a few that I was using and they were like, stop. So I had to rework it a little bit.
So Andrew, you won this year's FameLab, and you're going to go forward to the International FameLab,
yeah.
which sounds like International X Factor or something.
Yeah,
what happens there? Where are these other X Factor people from?
Well, you'd hope, because it is international, that it would have some glorious tropical location. It's going to be held in Cheltenham, which is a bit of a letdown. But the finalists are actually from all over the world. It's gone crazy in the last few years, FameLab. It started out as a UK competition sometime in the mid-noughties, if that's a word that people use. And it's grown exponentially across to loads and loads of different countries.
I've heard it's particularly popular in Eastern Europe.
Yeah, I think Bulgaria, the finalist in Bulgaria gets fated as a sort of national hero. It's incredible.
This could happen to you as well.
Yeah, I could be the most famous man in Bulgaria if I could just keep my cool for 6 more minutes.
And learn some Bulgarian, obviously, as well. That could be the thing. So what happens? You're up against all these guys, and then are you going to do the same skit, or have you prepared another one?
I'm actually not sure. I haven't prepared another one. I'm thinking about other topics, because, I mean, this topic selection thing is an absolute nightmare, coming up with something.
You could do something on viruses, Lucy. You could help.
I mean, yeah,
you.
If you've got any brilliant topics, then
why not branch out? Lucy, you're going to go along. Are you going to support Andrew? Have you got secret other international star that you're going to be supporting?
No,
he's looking over worriedly.
The Andrew flag. Yeah, he is. Yeah, no, I'm going to go along and support. But it'd be great to see the international ones as well.
So what happens to you two now? Are you going to go off and get TV contracts and then become Brian Cox's or whatever else? Is that what happens?
I wouldn't say no if anyone offered me one. They haven't yet.
But is that what you want to do? I mean, Lucy, what's your sort of goal out of all this? Because clearly having to prepare these 3 minute talks has taught you lots, and you can probably do that much more easily now. But what's next for you? Do you want to carry on being a researcher or do you want to go into this sort of thing full time? What would you do?
Yeah, it has taught me a lot, and I think it's really improved my research as well and the confidence. But I'm loving the research, and so I'd like to carry on as a researcher. But I have really enjoyed this, and FameLab has kind of, I guess, opened up or made me see the whole world of science communication.
What did you think of it before? What did you think it was?
To be honest, I'm kind of new to all of this. So I volunteered at the Cheltenham Science Fair last year just as a demonstrator, and that in itself was brilliant. The place was buzzing. Everyone was excited and enjoying the science. And so through them, I found out about FameLab, and that was a step up. So having seen this, I'd love to be able to carry on and do some more events and science communication alongside the research, if that's possible.
Tell me what a bit about both your research areas. So Lucy, viruses, you've got 1 year of your PhD left. What is it you do in your PhD?
So we work on norovirus, which I mentioned earlier. And one of the big problems we have is that for about, you know, people have been trying for like 30 years to try and grow the human norovirus in the lab, but we're still not able to. So there's some really massive questions that we still don't know, like how it infects, what cells it gets into, and even what the different virus proteins do when they manipulate your cells to replicate. And these are the questions you need to answer in the long run if you're going to be able to design antivirals. So one of the best ways to study it is to work on a related virus, which you find in wild mice and pet mice, as a colleague of mine found out by visiting mice pet shows. And we've been trying to image it and by adding something to the virus that will make it fluoresce. So this is brilliant because you can watch how it infects and try and find out how it gets into the cells and use it to develop antiviral screens as well that, you know, once if your drug works, you'll see a decrease in fluorescence. And it's a brilliant way to visualise it. So I'm getting close, hopefully one more year.
One more year and then will you have a cure?
I think that's a bit of a big statement, no. But we'll know a lot more, yeah.
So do you have a lab full of vomiting mice?
We don't, no. No, we work in the lab, maybe.
Can mice vomit?
No, mice can't vomit.
Why can't mice vomit? That's a fascinating question.
They don't have
question.
The reflex, I think, but it is
so
a fascinating question.
So what happens if
question.
They need to... get over a hangover or whatever else they need to do to comment with
a mouse hangover.
They just sit there being depressed.
On the ethanol.
Andrew, what about you? What was your PhD on?
My PhD was on magnetism, and it was looking at a particular kind of magnets called molecular magnets. And so ordinarily, when you think of magnets, you think of things like iron or cobalt or sort of metals, basically. But actually, we can make all kinds of different magnetic substances. And the stuff that I was looking at did have occasional bits of metal in it, in a regular crystal structure. But the rest of that crystal structure was made up of things like carbon and hydrogen and other organic materials. And the great thing about organic elements is they're very, very flexible chemically, which means that we can just, you know, pull out a certain bond or we can put in a different... We can substitute in different things into different places and make the distance between layers a little bit bigger and a little bit smaller and try to understand fundamentally what makes certain substances magnetic in the way that they are.
And could you make other things magnetic if necessary, for whatever reason?
Not usually, no. So actually most of the materials, so the way that you make something magnetic is it has to be magnetic itself to some extent. Then you can, say, for example, rub a magnet on it. And that's something called ferromagnetism. So it's where the entire material has all of its tiny little atoms inside it. They're all like tiny little bar magnets. And when they're all lined up in the same direction, you'd say the substance is magnetized. But most of the materials I'm looking at are something called an antiferromagnet, which means that instead of all the atoms lining up, the little bar magnets inside actually line up opposite to each other. And that means that externally, you can't tell it's a magnet very easily. It won't stick to the fridge. And so you're going to have to look at it with a bit more of a clever technique in order to try and see what's going on.
Now, given that you're a magnetic researcher, so to speak, maybe you can explain that crazy video that was going around a while ago with the super cooled magnet that was sort of hovering over a table. Now, we had Boaz Almog of the university in Israel who actually was doing that experiment. Mm-hmm. But it's a fascinating, it looks like levitation, quantum levitation is what they were calling it. I don't believe that's necessarily what it was, but can you explain that? Because I've not found anyone who can explain it in any way I understand.
Okay, so actually...
Just to remind people what it was as well.
So it was a disc of actually superconductor rather than a magnet, which was placed above a magnetic track and you could flick it around the track and it just keeps on going.
And turn it upside down.
You could move it and it would just stay wherever it was put. And this is because of a phenomenon called flux pinning. So the material is a superconductor. And a superconductor, as the name suggests, is super at conducting electricity. It's got zero electrical resistance. And that means if you set up an electric current inside it, it'll just keep on going round and round and round forever without ever stopping. And the other thing you need to know in order to understand it is the sort of relationship between electricity and magnetism. So if you bring a magnet near to an electrical conductor, like a piece of copper, you'll induce a current, so you'll create a current inside that copper. Now, if you do that with an ordinary metal like copper, then the current will just die away and nothing exciting happens. But because the superconducting current never dies away, that means it keeps on going round and around and around. And because of this intimate link between electricity and magnetism, then it itself creates a magnet that counteracts the magnet it's brought near. And that means that, for example, you brought it near a north pole, you'd create another north pole inside the superconductor. And those two north poles would then repel, and you can counteract gravity, and the thing will levitate.
Did anyone else understand that?
Are there any bits you need clarifying? There's quite a lot of steps.
I liked that explanation there. Andrew, thank you very much. Lucy, thank you very much. Now, they're going to be staying with me to discuss some of this week's science news. But for more information on this year's winners of FameLab and how to enter if you're a scientist with a passion to tell the world about your work, go to famelab.org. Ian Sample, the Guardian science correspondent, has joined us to talk about this week's news. Ian, welcome.
Hi there.
Now, you're going to talk to us about SpaceX. By the time you're listening to this podcast, SpaceX should have launched its first mission to the International Space Station. Tell us what SpaceX is, Ian, and what's so significant about its launch.
Well, SpaceX is a private company co-founded by Elon Musk, who is the PayPal guy, entrepreneur. And SpaceX, his company, it's the first time a private company has tried to launch and dock with the space station. Now, the flight, which was due to go up on Saturday, it's a test flight. And the company emphasized really strongly that this is a test flight in the true meaning of that sense. We're not really thinking about this as a mission because things could well go wrong. And by the time this podcast goes live, things may well have already gone wrong. And talking to people around the industry, they're saying, well, look, if they get a successful launch, that's good. This rocket, Falcon 9, has only flown twice before. Their previous rocket, Falcon 1, didn't make orbit the first three flights. The last two it did. Falcon 9's only flown twice before. It's worked really well, actually. It got to orbit. And the Dragon capsule, which it's carrying up there, no one's ever tried to dock anything privately with the space station and so on. So this is a bit of a moment, really. This, even though this is a test flight, what it shows is it's a step towards opening up space in a very different way towards private industry.
Now, the space shuttle was retired last year to much fanfare and sadness. And so is this the beginning of the replacement in America, the private replacement?
That's right. I mean, think about it. NASA's never built its own rockets. It's always gone to Boeing and Lockheed and people like that, say, to build the rockets. But previously, the model's been different. Previously, NASA has been heavily involved in the designs. It's given these companies as much money, essentially, as they need to build them, and then a whack of money on top as a profit. Okay, so you've essentially got state-funded rocket building. What this does is it says, okay, NASA pick a few companies and say, we want you to start running the cargo flights to the space station. Go away, build something that will work. We will work with you, but at arm's distance. You take the risks, you do you have the creativity, and you also have the competitive pressures to deal with from these other companies. So it totally changes the ball game. Now, there are other companies which NASA has gone to, and SpaceX actually is hoping to do this with the same capsule, is they're saying, okay, not only cargo, we want you to take the people up. So this is all part of NASA's move to say, okay, we've been doing sending people into space for more than 50 years now. About time private companies did it. We will then just pick from the market whoever's cheapest or whoever's most reliable, get you to do the low Earth orbit stuff, flights to the space station. NASA can then focus on other stuff. And that's what's really interesting about this, is also, that shift.
Also, the cost is potentially going to go down. I mean, the figures I've seen for the SpaceX launches potentially could be in the range of $50 to $100 million each when it gets going. Compare that to the shuttle, which cost hundreds of billions of dollars over its lifetime. It was meant to be literally a shuttle to space and back in, but it never was. I mean, Elon Musk and SpaceX, they're not the only people trying to get into space. So this is the vanguard of a lot of private companies that are getting up there. So competition will drive the cost down, won't they?
That's the hope. But there are a few things to think about here. First of all, I spoke to the head of Astrium Space Transportation that builds the Ariane rockets. And he said, I'm not being negative. I just don't know the answer to this question as to whether this will work. And what he was referring to was that when NASA brought on the shuttle program, it said, we're going to fly weekly to the space station. It's going to cost us not very much. I can't remember the figures to get there each flight. And it ended up that program over 30 years flew 130 odd flights at a cost of over $200 billion. So you can't say, and we won't be able to say probably for a decade, he reckoned, whether this has been a success or not. The other thing is that at the moment, US Congress is trying to force NASA not to have a bunch of companies that could fly humans up and down, astronauts up and down to the space station, but just to pick one, which immediately knocks out the whole point of doing this, because you need the competition. You need multiple companies to be doing it so that to get the benefits of the market forces.
Andrew, do you have any questions?
Yeah, I think my main query about this is definitely this monopoly problem. So how many other companies are even eligible for this sort of thing? How many people have, you know, how many private companies have a working space program?
Well, there are four companies that have been chosen to do the crewed missions. And one of them is Boeing. Then you've got SpaceX and a couple of other companies. And they're all serious. They're not, you know, guys working out their garages. So these guys are going to do it. And I think one of the nice issues about the SpaceX launch is that on one side, people you talk to will say, look, if they even get into space, if they get this capsule anywhere close to the space station, that is a success of some sort, and that will be a boost. But others will say, and I spoke to a guy at Surrey Satellite Technology, the British small satellite manufacturer, and he said, the good thing about SpaceX is it brings a lot of private money with it, it brings investors, but if it goes wrong, then, you know, investors and other companies that might be looking to come into space might think, actually, you know what, maybe you do need to be a national space agency with all the buffers and confidence that gives you of absorbing failures to do this. And, you know, private investors, VCs and such like might get really nervous if it goes wrong.
OK, well, let's move on from space to another futuristic technology. Lucy, do you want to tell us about the latest robotic arm interface? That sounds like a weird thing to say, the latest on that. Yes, well, what is the latest on that?
So it's the first, in fact. So it's a group from Brown University who are reporting in Nature originally the first report of a brain-controlled assisted robotic device. So what they've basically done is implanted a sensor into the brain of two paralysed patients, one of which has been paralysed for 15 years. They've connected this to a cable to a computer which controls an assisted, well, robotic arm. They then, to start off with, they asked the patients, they showed them a series of arm movements and asked the patients to imagine as if they were moving their arm themselves. And the computer was then able to register the signals from their brain that happened with particular arm movements so that they can program the computer. So that when it then receives, if the patient tries to move the arm, they receive the signals that tell it to, say, move right, and that will translate into a movement right of the robotic arm. So they released a video that shows this woman in particular controlling the robotic arm to be able to pick up a cup of coffee, bring it to herself and take a sip. Which was apparently the first time she's been able to do anything that independent in 15 years.
And something so simple is actually profoundly important for someone like that who's been paralysed for so long and so complicated to do. I mean, this device, BrainGate, Ian, we've talked about before. Give us some context. I mean, how long have these guys at Brown and at other places been working on it?
It's been going on for a good few years, actually, best part of a decade. And previously, what they've done is they've used this implant, and it's a really tiny thing. It's smaller than a pill, really. But you implant it directly into the brain, and then you have this sort of you have a unit that still protrudes from your, you know, sticks onto your skull that takes the cable out. But they've been using it previously with I remember reporting on a guy who was stabbed and was paraplegic after that, and he was using it to control a cursor, which he could use to sort of select and click on to open emails and do things like this. What's interesting about this latest work is they've got the coding really well, the decoding going on really well, so that they can take information from the patient's motor cortex and use that to move something in three dimensions with joints. And you can imagine how complex the signaling must be when you're picking ammonia up from a, you know, a tiny area on the brain.
And we're talking brain computer interface, we're talking computer modeling, we're talking robotics. This is a lot of technologies in one go, which is essentially trying to give people back normal function.
And it's still painfully crude, bear in mind. I mean, you just look at these patients and it's still incredibly crude. I mean, you know, you're cutting into their heads to implant this stuff. This woman is actually quite interesting in that she's had this implant for 5 years, which is the longest anyone's had an implant that they've been able to get useful signals out of. The problem is that you get brain scarring around where the electrodes go, and it interferes with picking up the signal. So there's a lot of stuff they need to do. You know, can you get signals reliably for a longer period of time? Can you do all this wirelessly so you don't go around looking like you've got you know, some big gadgets sticking out your head. There's lots more that needs to be done on this, obviously improving the robot arms themselves.
Yeah, I think they acknowledge that the success rate was only about 50%, so of attempts, the number of times they managed to connect with the target. So the movements are very sort of slow and not very accurate at the moment, and as you said, with the wireless. But I think the fact it was 5 years later has also kind of given hope that actually this could, you could do it in the long term.
So they were very brave doing it with a cup of coffee on this video.
So they do say they stopped it twice for fear of knocking it off the table.
That's not the worst I'm scared of.
She's obviously very, very, very practiced on the whole thing. Actually, Lucy, one more point on this was that there was an accompanying article in Nature by a colleague of these guys at Newcastle University talking about how this research has been going on for some time, and a lot of it was basic science, where they didn't really know if it was going to work or whether it was going to go anywhere useful. And then it produces something which, you know, now is on the verge of being very useful for people with strokes and who are paralyzed. That message about basic science without a purpose, do you tell that to people who, your friends, when you're talking about researching viruses? I flippantly asked about cures to neurovirus a few minutes ago. I didn't really mean it, but I mean, is that all they ask you about when you're doing your research?
I think a lot of research is focused on the why and the translational aspect, as in, does this lead to cures? But this is a brilliant example of how sometimes you have to start at the start. You know, it's 10 years or so of basic research, of learning how we control our movements and so on, to build in eventually to have the knowledge to fit with the technology. So it's a fine line. You know, a lot of research is geared towards answering the therapeutic questions, but sometimes you have to take a step back and answer the basic questions as well. So this is a great, and I think you could sense that in the video from the scientists as well as the patients.
Do you think they were secretly quite together, relieved that, phew, thank goodness it did have an application?
They were
after
massively
all that.
Relieved, yeah.
Andrew, let's move on to your story for this section. This is about drugs to reduce heart problems. Tell us about statins.
Yeah, so this is actually a sort of medical intervention in a rather later stage of development. These statins are drugs that are used to reduce the levels of blood cholesterol in people who are at risk of cardiovascular disease and heart attacks and that sort of thing. And there was a story last week about a paper that had come out. It's a new meta-analysis, so an accumulation of loads and loads of different studies covering about 175,000 patients who have been taking these drugs. And the surprising result was that these drugs aren't just beneficial to people who've got they've either had a heart attack or aren't at high risk of getting cardiovascular problems. Even if you've got very low blood cholesterol, it turns out that it can reduce your risk to take these things as a precautionary measure. And I think this is the first study to show that very clearly. And it even looks as though that this effect massively outweighs any side effects the drug might have. So it looks like a massively positive story.
So at the moment, it's given to people who doctors reckon have genetic or familial or some other preconceived risk of having some sort of heart disease. Whereas now they're saying perhaps you should take them on a regular basis, a bit like that half aspirin. The tablets people suggest that you take.
Yeah, so currently GPs are allowed to prescribe them if they think you have a 20% risk of developing a cardiovascular condition in the next decade. Okay. So the researchers are proposing that this limit be lowered. I don't think they're too keen to specify exactly how much. That's a job for
so
the regulators.
Great pills for everyone. That's fantastic. Yeah. Let's crunch down on them straight away. Okay, tell me what your issues with the story are.
So it was actually widely quite well reported, which is, I think, can be unusual for science stories. And even sort of the worst parts of the media, they were a bit sort of overhyping it and, you know, saying everyone should go to their GP and demand statins right now. But basically, all the statistics were accurate. They weren't really very misleading. My problem was, and this is applicable to a lot of science stories and a lot of news stories in general, the statistics, although they were correct, I couldn't get a handle on them at all. So they said that if we reduce this threshold from 20% likelihood of having a cardiovascular event in the next 10 years, if we reduce this threshold, we'd save 2,000 lives a year, and it would cost the NHS about £240 million.
So they're quite clear numbers, aren't they? Oh, no?
They're completely unintelligible to me. So without looking it up, I have no idea how many deaths there are a year in the UK. It's actually about 500,000, so 2,000 is of order, a bit less than 0.5%. And 240 million quid, it's very hard to get my head around that as well. You can think of it as a tiny, tiny fraction of the £120 billion NHS budget. But even that just sounds to me like a massive number being less than a humongous number.
So it's context you want.
I think the key word is definitely context. I want to understand, if I was a 50-year-old thinking of taking these things as a preventative measure, what are they going to cost me individually, and what's my personal risk going to be lowered by? And I think answering that question for me as an individual is very similar to answering whether as a society we should collectively pay for these things. Am I prepared, you know, to pay 20 quid a year on someone's behalf to reduce their risk of heart attack by how much, rather than saving 2,000 lives, which is very hard to get a sort of handle on?
I think the personal risk you mentioned is important as well in terms of what happens if you, can we overtake them? I mean, do they have bad side effects, and what the inconvenience of taking them from age 50 onwards as well, which I think that clearly the benefits are mentioned, but maybe it needs to be more balanced.
I think actually this has got a bit of an issue in the story. This feels like an issue of false balance here, because they often want to, you know, this looks like a wonder drug. This is a miracle cure story that the press often love. And so they're very keen to mention these drugs do have side effects. But a really common thing in all the different coverage was to state the side effects, but not state how bad or how likely they were. So there's some kind of muscular problem you can get, and there are some issues with your kidneys. But it didn't say that, you know, these happen to 0.1 of a person per thousand in some cases. And so to try and get a handle on how risky it is, you need to have some actual numbers rather than just saying there are side effects and, you know, how bad they are.
Ian, this is something that surely is in your cocktail of drugs you take every morning. Surely is, right?
I can't remember the last time I took anything, legal or otherwise. The cost in this study, or in the reports of the study, do they take into account the savings that the NHS would make because these people aren't keeling over in the street?
I think, yeah, so there's that, and there's also the issue that currently, because it's only given to people with high cholesterol, there's quite an expensive diagnostic test that has to be done. Whereas if you could just prescribe it on the hoof without having to do that test, you could probably save, you know, several years worth of statin treatments worth of money. Because these drugs are very, very cheap. They've recently, you know, some generic copies have started to come as the patents have expired, and so you can actually get a course of some kinds of statin for £16 a year, which, again, you know, that compare that to 240 million quid, that sounds like a very different figure from where I'm seeing.
Okay, we'll be distributing statins with this podcast from now onwards. Thank you all for your stories, and to read more about any of this stuff, go to guardian.co.uk/science. Now, Lucy and Andrew are just starting out in their careers as both scientists and science communicators. Perhaps a good role model for them is the clinical anatomist, author and broadcaster Alice Roberts. She's best known for her work on the BBC series Coast, as well as her contributions to Horizon and the series Origins of Us. Recently, she was appointed a Professor of Public Engagement at the University of Birmingham. She came into The Guardian studios to chat to the Comment is Free team. The Guardian's Philip Alterman spoke with Alice to discuss her new role and why she thought it was important for science and scientists to bust some widespread myths.
I'm really pleased to have been appointed Professor of Public Engagement at the University of Birmingham, and I think it shows that universities are realising that they really need to invest in this, that they need to be serious about it. And of course they're incredibly well placed to do it. If we're thinking about dissemination of science, who better to do it than the scientists themselves? They know their subject, they're enthusiastic about it, that's why they're doing it. And so they're the best placed people to communicate and to get this dialogue going. This is a really key thing, that it's not about educating the public. We're not talking about putting out science facts and making sure the public is educated. It's actually about a dialogue, it's about a communication. So that, in fact, there's a two-way flow of information, and that the public is fully informed about the science that's being done in this country, which, of course, is largely public-funded. But they're also involved in it in a really meaningful way, so involved in it in terms of the direction in which that science is going. Because I think there was something really dangerous that happened in the 20th century, and that was somehow that science became pushed away from the rest of society, and C.P. Snow identified this. And in his lecture in 1959, the annual Reed lecture at Cambridge, he said, look, we've got two cultures here and we need to break down the barriers between them and sort this out. Well, those two cultures still exist. We've still got a separation between science and society. And one of the big problems about that is that then there's an almost natural distrust. So there's a lack of trust that scientists are working for the good of society, for the good of humanity. Which is really sad, because I think you don't go into science for any other reason than that. You know, there might be a few people locked away in their labs doing evil things, but But by and large, the vast majority of scientists are doing it because they believe it's worthwhile.
I mean, the danger, of course, always with making things accessible is that they're being simplified in the process. Or, I mean, are there what are your sort of top three science myths that you would love to clear up? I mean, is there anything that that comes to mind there, sort of examples of things that people get wrong and you feel as a scientist you could correct?
My favourite myths about science and the scientific approach are, or not necessarily favourite, but my bugbears, are first of all that sometimes there's a response that you can't test something with science. And I'm thinking particularly when you look at things like complementary and alternative medicine. If somebody says, you can't test this using science, that means you can't ask the question, does it work? Which at the end is, you're really kind of extending common sense and saying, well, we can use science to actually see if this therapy works. And if we find that this therapy works no better than somebody pretending to do it, then we can say it doesn't work. And we do that in a randomised controlled trial. So, we can control for things. We can make sure that actually it's not just the placebo effect that's at work. We can actually discern the difference. So saying you can't use science to test something is basically saying you're not allowed to ask any questions. Just buy it. So that annoys me. Another thing that annoys me is people saying that evolution is only a theory, not a fact. And in fact, that was something I came up against when I was teaching on the medical course at Bristol University, and I was quite shocked when some students actually complained that I'd been talking about evolution in a lecture about locomotion, about the way that we get around as humans, and about the joints of our legs and all of that sort of thing. And if you look at it in an evolutionary way, actually it all makes a lot more sense. But these students complained that I was talking about evolution, and they specifically said that. They said, you're talking about it as a fact rather than a theory, which I think shows two things, that these students had done science at A-level, but they misunderstood science. They misunderstood the whole process of science. And the fact is that, the facts we have are theories, and they're theories that we have been very critical of, and we've tried to find the holes in them. And if they still stand up, then we say, this is the most probable explanation for all the evidence we see. So yes, it's a theory, but it's still the most probable explanation. And it also shows that I think they were failing to weigh up evidence, and that the evidence for evolution is, I think it's almost impossible. You have to not look at the evidence. If you don't want to believe in evolution, don't go and look at the genetics. Don't look at the fossils. And in fact, you don't even need to look at genetics and fossils. Don't look at any biology. Because just looking at the animals that are living on the planet today, remember, Darwin didn't have genetics. Mm-hmm. And there were no fossils of ancient humans when Darwin came up with his idea about how humans evolved. All you've got to do is look at animals living today. And the best explanation for life on Earth is that evolution has happened. That's only two, you asked for three. I couldn't think of another one. No, I rambled right. on so long about
that. That's fine, that's fine. A number of sort of public science figures around, you're one of them. And you have Brian Cox doing the sort of the stars and thing, and then you've got Marcus de Soto doing sort of abstract maths. Can you make your case for why, I mean, your field, which is a little bit more about things that you can actually grasp, why that's ultimately where things are at their most exciting, or science is at its most exciting?
I think every scientist thinks their own field is the most exciting thing they've ever seen. So for me, it's physical anthropology, biological anthropology, everything about the human body, how it works, how it all fits together, and how it evolved. I just find that utterly, utterly fascinating. And it's a subject which I think when I look back, I know we tend to invent these stories retrospectively about where these ideas have come from and how our lives have been shaped. But I can see myself as a child reading books about evolution and about ancient humans and being utterly fascinated by it, and going to Bristol Museum as a child and seeing a mummy being unwrapped on a live video link and just being completely, completely entranced by it. And I suppose exactly the same way as Brian Cox probably was, thinking about planets and solar systems and physics. Mm-hmm.
And what's in your field, what is the sort of the most pressing and most exciting question right now for research? What would you say?
The last decade has been an incredibly exciting one for anybody interested in human evolution. We've had about 10 new species appearing. It's phenomenal. So when you now look at the tree of humanity going back some 7 million years, it's now quite densely populated with different species. What we're not entirely sure of at the moment, and I don't know if we ever will be, is how all those species fit together in terms of ancestors and descendants. And that's absolutely fascinating. And also, we're not entirely sure about how we separated from chimpanzees. How much interbreeding was there before our two populations went their separate ways as they eventually did? And are some of the fossils that we think are early ancestors of humans actually ancestors of chimpanzees? I don't think we've really tackled those questions properly yet. And I think it could be a lot more extraordinary and exciting than we're thinking it might be at the moment. There are some particular fossils which I found incredibly intriguing. And I think the big one for me is Homo floresiensis, which is the hobbit, which was discovered on the island of Flores in Indonesia, and it's such a strange little skeleton. And one of the joys about making programmes for the BBC is that I go to places that actually as an academic I probably wouldn't go to, and I probably wouldn't get my hands on the original material. I laid out the skeleton of LB1, Liang Buo 1, from this cave in Flores, and when I laid it out, it literally sent shivers down my spine, because this is a tiny, tiny person, only stood a metre tall, and with a brain about 400 millilitres. You know, that's kind of a third of my brain size. And yet these tiny little humans made stone tools. So there's all sorts of weird things about them. First of all, their brains are really too small for us to call them Homo humans. But there they are, they're Homo floresiensis. Secondly, what are they doing in Indonesia? Who are they? Are they Homo erectus? Are they an earlier type of human that's got smaller and smaller on an island? Or could it be actually that Homo, our genus, didn't originate in Africa? It originated in Asia. What an exciting possibility. There are all these questions, and I think that's what makes science exciting.
Professor Alice Roberts there, and as I said, you can watch a video version of that interview on the Guardian website. Go to guardian.co.uk/comment. That's all we have for this edition of Science Weekly. You can keep up to speed with breaking science news at any time on guardian.co.uk/science. But from me, Alok Jha, and the award-winning Science Weekly producer Jason Phipps, it's goodbye.
Guardian podcasts are partnered with audible.co.uk. For a free download, be sure to check out guardian.co.uk/audible, where Guardian listeners can choose any audiobook for free. See the page for more details.
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.